Ideas by themselves don't make a creative economy. Just like cities and towns need infrastructure, such as roads, police, fire, and water, to have a successful local economy, what do individuals, organizations, and governments need to have in place to win in the creative economy? I'll be right back.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
Let's face it, we all need infrastructure. We need infrastructure just to survive day to day. We need infrastructure on our job, such as resources, management support, budgets, people. So infrastructure not only is there to support us, but it actually enables us. It allows us really to be successful. It's such things as having best practices, having the handbook to tell you how to do certain things, to have mentors on the job. In the case of infrastructure for towns where we may live, what do we look for? Best schools, public transportation, good shopping, access to clean water. Whatever the objectives are, whatever the infrastructure is important to us, we all look for it. But what is needed as infrastructure to win in the creative economy? Now, what I've done is I've taken a list or combined a number of lists that I've come across to boil it down to what I think are the top 10 items. So these are the 10 items that should be in place if you truly are going to win in the creative economy. First off, and if you've been a regular listener to this podcast, this is going to sound like I'm beating on the broken record, but this is 1, establish an innovation-friendly education system. As I've said many times before, the education systems today that are out there, at least the ones that I've been familiar with, have literally beat creativity and innovation out of the students. We need to go back and rethink, what does education really mean when you talk about the creative economy? And it's not just about teaching students on how to be artists or musicians. It's really equipping them with the skill sets. Just as we give them reading, writing, and arithmetic, we need to give them creativity. We need to get them innovation. Because the creative economy is not going to be just about the ability to learn a practice or learn a process and repeat it. In those cases of jobs, they are moving offshore. Programming, call centers, forms processing. It's really the ability to unlock the natural creative skills of students and eventually those workers that are in day-to-day jobs that's going to allow any region, any city, any country to truly win in the creative economy. 2, establish a set of bold, outrageous goals to focus the research and investment. Now, back in the 50s and 60s here in the U.S., it was all about the race for the moon. And when Kennedy laid out that bold, outrageous goal for us to be in the moon by the end of the decade going into the 70s, it allowed for a lot of focus on R&D dollars, what was happening in universities, and what was happening in private industry. Now, the result, however, has been that there's been literally millions of jobs created. There's been an entire economy that was created, a level of scientific expertise, of engineering resources that all came out of that. Universities creating engineering programs that have now gone on to train into other fields. You need to establish a set of bold, outrageous goals, or what I call BOGs, to focus the research and investment. Next is you need to strengthen the links between research and industry. Now, earlier in my career, I really thought that there was going to be this phenomenal opportunity to take R&D out of universities and commercialize it. And in fact, going into the late 80s, I spent a lot of time working with universities, trying to figure out ways to take the innovations out of those universities and bring them into market. Being young and naive, went into this with a lot of energy to quickly realize that it's a lot harder than it looks, particularly given that there aren't laws or mechanisms or ways to encourage that kind of linkage between industry and research. So you have to figure out how to strengthen the links between research and industry. Now, in some cases, some universities that I'm actually involved with now, we are actually sponsoring R&D programs that are occurring. We are actually sponsoring semester classes, and we're giving them the specific task or problem or area of innovation that we're looking for those students to work on. And it's been a phenomenal success for us. But you need to establish, and this is not only within companies, but also within governments, you need to find a way to strengthen the links between research and industry. Next, you need to encourage the innovation transfer between research and industry. Now, as I was talking before, spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make all this work. It is extremely hard. Until what we call the Dole Act passed here in the United States, which allowed for the ease of intellectual property ownership between university research and enterprise, it was incredibly hard. And even today, it is still incredibly hard. You've got a phenomenal amount of research and technologies locked up in universities without an efficient way to transfer those out and get those into commercial products and offerings. Next, and this is a big one, you need to provide some form of R&D investment incentives, tax incentives, however you want to think about it, to encourage investment. It's all about having available capital. Why does Silicon Valley exist where it exists? Because of just simply the wealth of capital that is willing to take risks and make investments. And the typical rule is that VCs invest locally. They invest where they literally can get into the car and be at one of their portfolio companies that day, not where they have to get onto an airplane or have to do anything else. Now, believe me, I've lived all over the U.S. I've lived overseas. I've seen where companies locally say, but you know, we want to stay in this little niche town or little area because we like it locally. And don't worry, we have such a great idea that the VCs will be willing to invest. Believe me, I've been involved in it for so long, you just don't see it. So what needs to happen, for instance, in local economies, local regions, maybe you're not Silicon Valley, maybe you're a country that you're looking to establish some form of innovation programs. If you're a small city or a region away from really the major hubs, you need to figure out some way to provide an R&D investment incentive or tax incentives to encourage that investment. Because without cash, it's very, very hard. I wouldn't say impossible, because I never say that reality, but it is extremely hard to bring that commercial product to the marketplace. Next is you need to nurture local and regional innovation funding. Now, this in many cases can be things such as matching dollars. So if you get local investors to put money in, then the region, the states, the countries, however you defined your local geographies, can then do some kind of matching funds. Now, I've seen this work very, very well here in the U.S. particularly, and I've seen it work in economic development zones overseas. I've also have been involved in securing funds or matching dollars from the World Bank for core infrastructure, for telephone infrastructures into sub-Saharan Africa in the 90s. And I've seen the impact that that's had on local economy. It works. You need to think through the process. You need to figure out what is the right match and how do you measure success. But you also have to recognize that governments, regions, cities, they're not the right people to make the decisions as to which investments they should make. You need to partner with those that are in the risk capital markets in order to help make those decisions, to get the right returns, to put the money in the right place, to make the right bets. But you need some way of nurturing local and regional innovation funding in order for this to be successful. Next is you need to support innovation development through public and private procurement. Now, This is an area actually where the U.S. government has done extremely, extremely well. So here in the U.S., for instance, we have what we call SBIR, Small Business Innovation Research Funds. So problems are defined by different parts of the U.S. government where they need a solution, typically something that's fairly challenging on the technical aspects or things that they need very quickly, short cycle time. And they'll issue an SBIR. Now, this is aimed specifically at small businesses. So this is an excellent venue for small businesses where you've got really, really creative individuals, great resources from a standpoint of expertise, but maybe not a lot of money. You can actually propose your solution to the problem, and the government then would actually make a small business innovation research grant funding to you that you would allow to be used to create the solution. So this is one example. I'm sure there's other parts in the world that are doing something similar to that, but this is a situation where they're off. The government's going to go buy something. They need this solution, and they specifically structure it as an innovation program in order to try to encourage small businesses, individual inventors to propose their ideas. So you're not up competing against the big guys. These are allocated specifically towards individual inventors, small businesses, etc. And then next, you need to ensure a proper and appropriate protection for intellectual property. Now, there's a lot of battles and arguments over IP and IP ownership and who should have the right to make those investments or get the returns, license them, get return on those investments, whatever those arguments are. The reality is it's all about incentive. It's me as an inventor coming up with an idea, knowing that if this idea really takes hold and that somebody's really going to take this product and it's going to find its market, that I'm going to have some way of reaping the benefits, reaping the reward for my ideas. Without that linkage of incentive, what encouragement other than goodwill is there to come up with more and more ideas? And I think that's why you see certain economies today that are really driving or really showing quick growth towards this creative economy are those areas where governments are structured in such a way where people can keep the rewards that they get. And so part of this is not just appropriate protection of IP, but also to make sure that there's the appropriate incentives, meaning that if I create the intellectual properties and I go through the process of protecting it, whether it be trade secrets, copyrights, patents, whatever, that I'm going to get the reward for the effort in coming up with that idea. Now, if you've been counting, you'll notice that there's only 8 listed so far. So where are the other 2? That's where you come in. What would be the other infrastructures needed for individuals, organizations, and governments to win in the creative economy? So what would be the other 2 that you would add to the list? So log in to killerinnovations.com, and on the comments to the show, give the other 2 you would add. So in the show notes, click on comments, and you can add the 2 that you think ought to be added. So I've come up with the first 8. For some reason, everybody thinks that there ought to be 10. The list always are 10, you know. So I've come up with the first 8. Your job is to come up with the next 2. So here's your chance. And here's really is your chance, because a number of private and public institutions, government agencies, listen to this podcast and log on to look at the show notes. So here's your venue to come up with what you think infrastructures are needed. Because I have a number of private and public institutions that specifically listen to this podcast, and they don't participate in many cases in the Killer Innovations community, but they pay attention to what I said. So here's your chance. I've come up with the first 8, come up with the next 2, log on to killerinnovations.com and post your 2 ideas to come up with a total of 10. What would be the 2 infrastructures needed to win in the creative economy? Have you ever noticed that ideas can come from the strangest places? From other industries, other geographies? I mean, I travel all over the world. I just got back from Europe last week. It's kind of the strangest experience when you're out there, you're traveling, and then all of a sudden you see something that you can then connect with something else that you're working on, and you've got the answer that you've been looking for. Well, this week's killer questions, and actually there's a series of them, is really about this whole process of learning, of observing, or finding those kinds of linkages. Now, you can sit back and you can wait until they just emerge and come to you, or you can actually be proactive and go out there and search for them that are going to have that really nugget, that real killer idea that's going to have that impact on your business. So first off, what industries have a value chain structure similar to yours? Now you're going to say, okay, I'm in X industry. You know, what do you mean? Well, let me give you an example. My father and my father-in-law both were involved in the steel industry, machine tooling industry, turning metal into finished products, whether that be automobiles or airplanes, rockets for NASA, or the aluminum can that you may be drinking a drink out of right now, where I actually came out of work that both my father and my father-in-law were involved in. So what's similar to machine tool? Well, you would think, okay, manufacturing of autos, but that's kind of a little bit too close. You really want to look far away. So think about it. Fast food, or what we call the quick serve restaurant space. What happens in machine tool industry? Well, you take in raw material, you transform it into something that looks nothing like it did before, resulting in a product that someone buys from you. Same thing with fast food. You bring in raw goods, heads of lettuce, maybe hamburgers, chicken. You cook it, you put it together, something that looks maybe a little appetizing. Someone buys it, and they walk away with that product. So look through what industries have a value chain structure similar to yours. And don't get hung up on looking ones that are yours and maybe the ones right next door. Look far away. Look, really reach out into other, looking at other industries. Now, for each industry that has a value chain structure similar to yours, what are the leading management practices? What is it that they do in that industry that's just part of the normal industry practices or best practices that they have in that industry segment? Now, make an entire list. Now, that list will be from each industry. So now you've got this combined list. So let's say you had three industries, each with five practices. You now have a list of 15 practices that are not part of your industry, but that are part of other industries that have something of a similar value chain structure to yours. And then for each of these management practices, come up with 10, not 9, not 8, but 10 ideas for your business on how to apply this practice. So I'll go through this again. What industries have a value chain structure similar to yours? For each industry, what are the leading management practices? Make an entire list. And then for each of these management practices, come up with a minimum of 10. Not 9, 10 ideas for your business on how to apply this practice. And I think out of that, you will find at least a handful of killer ideas that you can apply immediately. This week's closing thought is about leadership. Now, being a leader is not about commanding people to do your bidding. I know a lot of people want to get into that first management slot, and then all of a sudden they get into this little bit of a power kick. It's not about getting people to do your bidding and then sit back and think that you've now hit easy street. It's all about change. If you really are a leader, you're very focused and very interested on changing your team to become better. Just as we talked in the last podcast about how to create a high-performance team. How to change you, because guess what? When you move into that management ranks, you realize how little you really know. So how do you change you so that you can be someone others will follow? And then how do you change your organization? How are you going to change the organization to win? So what's your role as a leader with your team to change the organization? Then how do you, as an individual citizen within your respective countries, how do you change your government to be better? Now, your role as a leader in each of these is different. Your role in changing your team, the changing of you so that you can become a leader, the changing of your organization, the changing for you as a citizen and how you change the government to be better. And each of the, like I said, each of those roles as a leader is different. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow said it best. In this world, a man must either be an anvil or a hammer. Now, those are profound words. Now, when are you an anvil and when are you a hammer? And is it at the appropriate time? Hey, thanks for listening. Keep the feedback coming. Been getting a lot of great emails. You can always drop me an email at podcast@killerinnovations.com. I've started the personal blog. I mentioned it in the last podcast. You can see it at philmckinney.com. And it's in addition to the podcast and everything else. Stop by, take a read, leave your comments. And while there, check out the other parts of all the content that I'm working on producing and making available to you, which includes the books and tools, accompanying speaking engagements, the show notes for the podcast, and the Killer Innovations community site, where you can make connections with other innovative-minded people. While I was in Europe last week, I met up with a few listeners. I really do enjoy getting a chance to meet with the listeners face-to-face. So if you're in an area where I'm going to be visiting, and you can find out by visiting the blog, send me an email at podcast@killerinnovations.com, and I'll make every effort possible to try to get face-to-face. We have two winners for the Killer Innovations podcast promo competition. One is a video, which is very, very funny. And the other is an audio promo, which is more like about a 15-second commercial for the podcast. If you want to see the video or listen to the audio, visit killerinnovations.com. Now, I've also gotten a lot of other kinds of ideas and other kinds of formats. So I'm probably going to open up a second round of this competition. Not right now, but in a little bit of time. And again, the prizes will be you get your own personal deck of the entire set of killer questions. So rather than you having to write down all the killer questions that come out in the podcast, you'll actually get your own card deck, which will have the entire set or close to the entire set. And in fact, I still haven't even gone through all of the killer questions in the podcast. So you'll actually, if you win the competitions and you get your own card deck, you'll actually have more information than even what I've been able to share so far in the 80-plus episodes of the podcast so far. Don't forget to vote. Vote for your favorite podcast. The easiest way to vote for Killer Innovations is to visit killerinnovations.com and look for the vote box on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. I really do appreciate all the listeners out there. I also really do appreciate all the kind words and encouragement. Keep them coming. It allows us to keep the energy level up and keep the commitment to produce this podcast as often as we do. But again, thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.